Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 532nd episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter Podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a second-generation Hollywood legend who has to his name two Oscars, one for producing and the other for acting, 10 Emmy nominations, one of which resulted in a win, 5 Golden Globe Awards, as well as the Globe's Cecil B. DeMille Award, 2 SAG Awards, a Critics' Choice Award, and career achievement honors from the AFI, Film Society of Lincoln Center, Producers Guild of America, National Board of Review, César Awards, and film festivals in Cannes, Carlo Vivari, and San Sebastian, among others. Now, in his 6th decade in the business and nearing his 80th birthday, he's still going strong, most recently producing and starring as Benjamin Franklin in the Apple TV Plus limited series Franklin, which will begin rolling out on April 12th. The great Michael Douglas. Over the course of our conversation at the Montecito Inn in Santa Barbara, Douglas and I discussed what it was like growing up in the shadow of his father, the Golden Age movie star Kirk Douglas, how he made his own name acting on TV in the streets of San Francisco from 1972 through 1976, producing 1975's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and producing a number of projects in which he also acted, including 1979's The China Syndrome and 1984's Romancing the Stone. How he came to be part of some of his other best-known films, including the 1987 double whammy of Fatal Attraction and Wall Street, 1992's Basic Instinct, and 2000's Wonder Boys and Traffic, and why he so relished the opportunity more recently to step away from contemporary stories and into period pieces in 2013's Behind the Candelabra and this year's Franklin, plus much more. And so without further ado, let's go to that conversation. All right, Mr. Douglas, thank you so much for doing this. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Scott. My pleasure.
So we always on this podcast begin with a certain pair of questions. Where were you born and raised? What did your parents do for a living? Which I think we can cut some of that here because I think people... But the reality is your story from my research is actually a bit more nuanced than people might have realized, right?
Yeah. Well, they always do the Hollywood royalty story. My folks, God, got married in 1944, the year I was born. Mm-hmm. They got married and were only married until I was like 5 or 6. It lasted as long as when my father, Kirk, came out to California for his first movie. But my mother was an actress, and they met at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York. And when they first were living in a one-room studio apartment in Greenwich Village in New York, and my mother's older sister was married to Seward Johnson, the founder of Johnson & Johnson back there. So they had a big-ass estate in New Brunswick, New Jersey. They would go out there on weekends. This is a lovely place to get out of the city. My mom got pregnant, and one of those weekends are out there. I guess that was it. And so I was born in New Brunswick, New Jersey, 1944. And then they only lived... Well, they were married till the first year that my father went out to Hollywood.
Is that a coincidence?
No, let me say no more.
Right.
You know, and let's just say he was a little overwhelmed by the whole Hollywood experience.
Right.
And my mother said, "Well, that's it." And she packed my brother Joel and I up.
Right.
And we moved back to New York City. But mind you, this is very early in my father's career, and royalty was far, far away. He
right.
was the ragman's son
right.
from Amsterdam, New York. And so we were able to afford a small apartment on the Upper West Side in New York,
mm-hmm.
where I grew up
yep.
in New York, and then would come out on holidays wherever my father was filming.
Right.
You know, those are the days, you know, where there's hardly any television, maybe just two television stations, NBC, CBS. And that was it. And so we would visit him on holidays and basically grew up back east in a middle-class lifestyle, to say the least.
Again, in
prepping, I felt like I knew a little bit about you before this. I had the opportunity to interview your dad a few times, and you once, way back when, but I did not realize you've said basically that your stepfather was really the primary male influence during your childhood, right?
He was. Yeah. He was. Nothing against my father. He was just working his ass off, yeah. You know. It was said 5 pictures a year and meant well. But right up till his death, was always supportive of Bill Darin, mm-hmm. Who he called, Dad called my surrogate father. Yeah. And I just remember him as the first man who listened to me. He married my mother when I was 12. I was a lovely man, and basically we grew up in a small farmhouse in Westport, Connecticut, and I have fond memories, lost them much too young. And I was fortunate in the fact that my father and my stepmother and my father and my stepmother and my mother and my stepfather were best of friends.
That's great. Yeah.
They get along all the time. So all the years, there was no kind of stress. And we're always, the four of them used to love to have dinner together, preferably without the kids.
Right.
So it was a good being. So I'm always supportive of step-parents.
Right.
I think they get a short shrift a lot of times. We hear Cinderella stories about the mean old step-children, all of that. But yeah. The reality is there's a lot of wonderful mothers and fathers, step-parents, who, out of the love for their spouse, supports their step-kids.
Totally. So what really initially brought you back out west was college, right? In fact, we're talking in Santa Barbara. You came out here, and my sense was that the only reason that theater or drama really became the focus was just it seemed like a relatively undemanding major.
You got it, Scott. No, I was, you know, fortunate enough, my father paid for private boarding schools back east. They were all boys' schools at that time. And finally, I was getting my senior year at my boarding school and just deciding what colleges. And you go to your college counselor, and it's sort of like travel agents with their brochures. And I was, they were thumbing through the brochures, and I said, stop. Let me see that. And there was a brochure he pulled out. There was no Ivy League building, no nothing. It was just a guy walking down the beach carrying a surfboard with 2 girls in 2-piece bathing suits. In 1963, you never saw a 2-piece bathing suit back east. So I said, that's where I want to go. It was the University of California, Santa Barbara. And, of course, my dad said, oh, isn't that wonderful? He wants to see me. He wants to come out and be back here out in California to see me. And I said, okay, Dad, that's good, too. And, and so it turned out to be a great time for the whole UC system, 1963. Ronald Reagan had really done tremendous efforts for improving the university system at that time, although I can't say it was of great interest to me because I lasted 1 year, and then they suggested maybe you ought to take a break.
Take
a little break for a year and come on back.
Right.
They're very nice. So, and I was immersed in early 60s, kind of becoming a hippie in that whole environment, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful, magical, innocent, great time, tainted, of course, by the war in Vietnam and social causes. But I loved my time here at the Santa Barbara, and then in my first marriage to Deandra, we lived here in Santa Barbara for a number of years. So when Dad, just before Dad passed away, he had a weekend home up here, kind of from even the years when I was here long before, which just before he died, he wanted me to have, which I was really touched. And so Catherine and I kind of fixed it up. It hadn't been touched for a long time.
Yeah.
And just been a little place we can come out and hang out here and good memories. And
wow,
Catherine loves
great.
It too.
Now, when your dad first came to see you in Santa Barbara, what was his review of your work?
Well, he was very good about coming up. So I finally decided, when I went back to college, they called me into the office and said, you got to declare a major. You know, you're going to be going into your junior year. You got to have to major. You can't just take general education courses. I was like, I don't know, man, far out, a major. I had no interest. Acting was the last thing I was thinking about, probably kind of a natural hostility growing up because their career took them away from me as a kid and all that, so I had no interest in it. But then I realized, well, it's probably the easiest course, the major I could think of, because I didn't know a lot about. My mother was an actress in the theater, of course, my dad. So I took theater, began to do shows. I think my first show was Much Ado About Nothing, a Shakespeare play, where I played a messenger. And wouldn't you have it, the stage directions had me coming down through the audience, down through the on the aisle, straight down through the audience, screaming my messenger speech to the stage. And of course, I stopped right by where my father was sitting, you know, there. And they showed, and they told me how to put my hands on my hips, and my lord, and I took a big breath. And I ran out, and the theater said, What did he say? And Dad came backstage and looked at me and said, you were terrible. You were just terrible. And I know what he meant. And I wasn't a natural.
Well, that was the end of period pieces for a long time, right?
That was the end of period pieces till Franklin.
Right.
And so I just slowly started. I had terrible stage fright. I used to keep a wastebasket off stage and puke before I'd go on. And struggled through trying to get better, slowly did, and by the end of before graduating, Dad was wonderful. He actually, with all his hectic schedule, came to most of my shows, and by the end, he said, son, you were good. You were really good.
Well, for you, the interesting thing was you could have easily just gone down the highway and gone right to L.A., but something seems to have struck you, like, let's instead go to New York, some off-Broadway, some neighborhood playhouse, right? And then it was a CBS Playhouse episode that I guess is what sort of drew enough interest to have you come back out here. So what, as far as those early years as you're trying to make a name in the business, you were good, but it seems like the projects were not getting noticed for a while, right?
No. The first big move was, and again, I have to thank my stepfather, Bill, because he was originally on the board of an organization called the Eugene O'Neill Memorial Theater in Waterford, Connecticut. They had a program called the National Playwrights Conference. And so my last 2 years in college and my first year afterwards in the summers, 3 summers, I'd go up there as part of a small acting company doing new plays. And so all the focus was about the playwright. And you as actors were just there, and the playwright, the director, would be changing lines. And organically, I started realizing, well, you know, maybe there's 20 actors that could play the part, but there's only one playwright. And this playwright, and working this, so I learned the importance of material. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot about structure. So then after that, I went into off-Broadway, did some shows, was sort of discovered in a CBS Playhouse, which brought me out to California under contract with CBS Films, and proceeded to do 2 or 3 unnoticeable films I would recommend. Adam at 6 a.m. was one that I would recommend. The other ones I'm not too sure about. Began to drift into episodic television, FBI, Medical Center. And then my agents came to me with Streets of San Francisco, which was a lawsuit that Quinn Martin, who was a huge producer at that time, had many shows on television, Cannon, The Fugitive, Barnaby Jones, a whole bunch of shows, was a lawsuit that he'd won with this brand new network called ABC.
Right.
And I guess they had promised him a show or something, reneged, and he sued them, and he won. And what he won was a commitment for a 2-hour movie followed by 26-hour shows for the first season. So that was a big commitment. And my agent said, I know movies, but you should seriously think about this. And then the cherry on the sundae was Carl Malden.
Right.
Carl Malden, who was just a wonderful actor, had an incredible career, say, mostly supporting actors and major stars. Marlon Brando always wanted to work with him. And the combination of working with Carl Malden for 4 years, 104 hours of television, the structure of the epilogue, three acts, the prologue, or the prologue, the epilogue, was just reinforced by a whole sense of structure, as well as learning a whole lot about production, because we were shooting on location in San Francisco. That was a 6-day-a-week shoot on location. 8.5 months straight through, just working. So I learned a tremendous amount about production, guest actors every week, new directors, tremendous amount about acting and the camera and film and all that. So it was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity and really made my life. And Carl Malden was really my mentor. He had a work ethic that was beyond none.
Now, some people would ask, you know, here you are, it's a hit show, you're in your 20s still, and after the fourth season, I believe, is when you say, I'm actually going to leave, which might not be the obvious move, although it does sound like you were being worked like a mule. What was the first inkling that you could also be a producer? Because I know this kind of leads into One Floor of the Cuckoo's Nest, which is right up there with my and so many other people's favorite movies. But you, again, by the time that comes together, 30 years old, not, you know, for a first project it's as a producer, it's incredible. And so can you just share how that property even crosses your radar, and then how you and Saul Zantz end up getting it across the finish line?
I will. I think 1960, my father was in Spartacus at the top of his film career, major star. He had a production company, as you know, he did a lot of pictures, and he produced also. And one of the projects that his producing partner, Eddie Lewis, found was a book in galley form called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest by Ken Kesey. And Dad optioned the book in galleys and developed it as a play with Dale Wasserman. And I believe it was 1961, 62, I don't have the exact year, he developed it and he went back to Broadway, the height of his career, and made a 6-month commitment run to do this play, playing R.P. McMurphy, with the hope of the belief, like a lot of people, that he'd show the play and it'd be successful, there was a movie in it, and then he would make a movie out of it. Well, it wasn't successful. Gene Wilder was in the show, amongst others. It was a wonderful cast, but it didn't work. And he took it and went back to Hollywood. Okay. So, 63, I go to college. 64, I'm taking a class in 20th century American literature, and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is now on the reading list. It was a great, great book. And I remember loving it and thinking, wow, this is what a wonderful story. And so I go through school. Meanwhile, Dad has been trying for a number of years to try to get the movie set up, he's unable to. He just can't. Nobody says, I guess the big thing, nobody wants to see Snake Pit. I think that was the big, nobody wants to see Snake. I wish I had looked earlier. Snake Pit was a big success.
I think Olivia de Havilland got nominated.
She did, yeah. You know, but everybody's like, oh, it's crazy. Nobody wants to do a picture about crazy people. So I had begun now. Out My Own was beginning my career, as this would be before mm-hmm. Cuckoo's Nest, mm-hmm. before Streets of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And I heard by the office one day with Dad, and I heard that he was selling the property, just nothing was happening, he wanted to sell it. And I said to Dad, don't, it's such a wonderful project. Look, let me run with it, okay? Give me here, let me run with it. We'll try to get, I know you want to play the part. And I'll try to do, the whole thing, get a production together and all of that. So he thought, what the hell, I'm a kid. And so he said, okay, sure, run with it. Well, it was a lot more than a year, and thankfully he wasn't keeping track.
Right.
But while I was doing Streets of San Francisco, And I did my homework. I found that one of the people that expressed interest was a guy named Saul Zantz, who had a record company in Berkeley, California, named Fantasy Records. Berkeley is right near San Francisco. So what happened over the last couple of years on the show is I was able to work with Saul, and we partnered on it, and to nurture and develop. Saul, may he rest in peace, went on, I have to acknowledge, and he has won Best Picture in three different decades.
That's amazing.
Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, and then English Patient, three different. But on that one, at that time, we were both virgins. We he did a little picture, but we pretty much were just starting it. And what happened is that finally, by my fifth year, we were ready to do the production of Cuckoo's Nest. And I asked both Carl Malden and Quinn Martin to let me out of my contract in the fifth year. And they knew my interest in Cuckoo's Nest. They thought I was crazy to leave this hugely successful show. But they said, fine. I mean, that would never happen today, by the way. No. None of these places would allow you to walk out of your contract, you know, without saying so. I'm very grateful for them. And the, kind of the rest is history on Cuckoo's Nest, but it was my first attempt at producing, which I never thought of doing, but was shocked about how much I had learned in the 4 years of working on Streets.
Now, was how did your dad take it when, I guess, I think it's Saul Zantz's insistence, or no, me, you guys pick a then relatively unknown in this country director, right, Miloš Forman from Czechoslovakia, and he wants... I guess he felt that your dad was now too old?
Yeah, that was a bit of a tough one, although I think he was just sort of totally stunned to get the picture going. And yes, I was able to make a producing deal with Dad's company, and half of my producing deal went to Dad. And I took solace in the fact that it was still the most money he ever made on any picture that he'd done in his career and all of that. But as far as playing R.P. McMurphy, no. You know, Dad was in his early 60s by then, and Miloš, although initially he sort of blamed me, I don't know, he half-jokingly, but I think there was some seriousness in it. And I said, well, wait a minute. All of a sudden, the producer has final casting. I thought it was director's dad.
Right,
but
right.
And Miloš was interested. He had a couple of other interesting ideas. I remember he was very high for a while. He was thinking Burt Reynolds. Burt Reynolds would be. I said, Burt Reynolds, huh? I can kind of see that. But why Burt Reynolds, Miloš? Yeah, Burt Reynolds, he has cheap charisma. I said, okay, I'm going to listen to that,
right.
Which is perfect for R.P. McMurphy.
Right. Well, it comes together with, I know your buddy from, I think, Connecticut, Danny DeVito and Christopher Lloyd and Brad Dourif and Will Sampson. I know there's a bit of a sad story with that William Redfield, and but just so great. And I, here you are at the Oscars 41 years after the only other time that a film wins picture, director, actor, actress, and screenplay, and it didn't happen again until Silence of the Lambs, and that's it. So I guess I just wonder, that night for you, just what's that like generally, but B, was there a moment where you didn't think acting was acting ever in doubt that you would continue to act going forward now that you're having such success as a producer?
No, there wasn't. However, on one side now, I was an Academy Award-winning movie producer.
Right.
On the other side, I had been an actor in a television show. So now I start off, and I still want to act, but as a producer, I'm not approved as an actor for many projects. For instance, we had a project called Starman, which Jeff Bridges did. I would have liked to have done that part, that picture, but I was not approved. So it was one of the situations, and then I went on and developed this picture, The China Syndrome, and was able to develop a smaller of the three parts with Jane Fonda and Jack Lemmon, a part for me. And then on Romancing the Stone, They were very happy to get Kathleen Turner because she just was coming off of
Body Heat. Yeah.
Thank you. And but they wanted me. I went after Burt Reynolds. I went after you know, Jack Nicholson. I went after Gene Clint Eastwood. They all passed, and fortunately, the studio said I could do it.
So it wasn't really until Romancing the Stone that people began to acknowledge you as a movie star in your own right, right?
Correct. And even, I would say, far from being a movie star, I was like a lucky break. So I smelled and sensed the disparity between television and feature films, the prejudice that exists in our industry and the kind of stigma that stuck with it, because as I went on, I realized, gee, only Clint Eastwood and Steve McQueen were the only two actors I could think of before me that had made the transfer from television into feature films.
And now, meanwhile, everybody wants to go the other direction.
Right. Well, this streaming has been a godsend for a lot of reasons.
I just have to follow up one thing on the China Syndrome, because, again, not a bad early producing credit, and I guess... First, to want to note that, oddly enough, Oregon, I guess, came to the rescue of both Cuckoo's Nest and China Syndrome, right? There was...
Well, we used... I went back to Oregon because they have the Trojan nuclear power plant outside of Portland. And because of my connections before in the state of Oregon, they allowed us to come up and explore the plant, take a tremendous number of pictures. Even so, they realized warily that maybe this was not the best intentions for their industry.
Well, and that leads to part B here of the China Syndrome thing, which is you guys took a lot of crap for that. And it was, can you just kind of share for people who don't know the punchline after all these, you know, you crazy sure. Hollywood hippies and all that, and then all of a sudden...
Well, Jane Fonda was, you know, coming off of her Vietnam War activity and was very unpopular with corporate America in particular. And a lot of people felt it was irresponsible for the movie industry to even delve into this area where they knew so little about. And mind you, I saw the script originally as a horror movie, A Man Against Machines. As a result of doing the research about nuclear power plants and everything, I became very active in being anti-nuke. But as we got closer to the film and being dismissed, the picture opened, and it opened, you know, fairly well. But then 13 days after the movie opened, Three Mile Island, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania accident happened. And so for me, this was a complete epiphany. I'm not a religious person, but this is how I was feeling. And as we did research, in the China Syndrome, we have a big finale of a possible meltdown. And we had GE quality assurance experts who had lost faith and come over to the other side, who worked out in a computer scenario what the most normal 150 steps that they thought would happen would be the most likely for an accident to happen. And people started comparing our movie with the actual accident at Harrisburg, and 90% of those 150 steps were exactly the same from our movie and the tragedy.
And in your movie, don't you say something like it would be the size of Pennsylvania,
yeah.
And then this happens in Pennsylvania.
Exactly.
It's crazy. But there was something that I read just purely quick. I'd done much of the prep before today for this, and then I go and look at the New York Times this morning, and there's a big piece on a woman named Diane Thomas who wrote Romancing the Stone, which you also produced, and which was the beginning of this now three-film collaboration that you had with Kathleen Turner and Danny DeVito as a trio. And it's just an amazing story that I had no idea about. This is a waitress who writes the script in her off time. She did not write for reasons that I'll leave to you, but just, you know, Jewel of the Nile, a sequel comes out the next year, War of the Roses is its own thing. But this was, people forget how, I think, how big of a hit Romancing the Stone was, and that how groundbreaking to have a female-centered character in that genre, and you're, again, largely responsible for this as the producer and the star, but just, you know, would you have ever imagined... You've said it was the most well-rounded script. That was the thing in the article today. The most well-rounded script you'd ever read.
Yeah, it was excellent. I mean, yeah. I said, I read it one time. We got to get this. Yeah. We got to get this. Was fortunate enough to get the script. I didn't know the whole history about Diane. Yeah. Just read the script, and we got it. I forget what the article, what we paid for it. At that time, it was a lot of money, like $100,000, $150,000 in 77. And people accused us, questioned about spending so much money on a first-time writer, and my feeling was then, and it has always been, first time, 15th time. I mean, if the script is good,
right. That's
that. If you start figuring out the script is that good, that means you don't need rewrites. If that script is that good, that means you got a movie. So it was a wonderful experience all the way around. The article in the New York Times sort of explains it in terms of kind of resurrecting Bob Zemeckis' career at that time. It's hard to imagine, but I think he was feeling like his career was over at 28 because the two pictures he'd made, I Want to Hold Your Hand and Used Cars, with Spielberg executive producing, hadn't worked out. And he was like writing. And anyway, he came in and it was a good experience. But I think what you're getting at, Scott, is that when it came time to do in the studio immediately with the success of Romancing the Stone, wanted to do a sequel. And I sort of agreed to it. We started working on The Jewel of the Nile. Diane Thomas now is a hot writer.
39 years old, I think.
Yes, 39. She was a real hot writer. And so she was unable, she wasn't free to write the sequel.
Yeah.
So we went ahead and we worked on it with a couple of teams. But then when it came close to production, I needed what's called a punch-up, you know, a little help, and I wanted Diane to take a look at it, although she couldn't really contractually do anything because she was involved with some other projects. But she gave me like a weekend, a long weekend, a few days to sort of do some things, and I asked her, what can I do for you? She said, well, I need a new car. So I said, well, what do you want? She said, well, I'd love to get a Porsche. And I said, all right. And so went by, and then after the picture was over and I got back and I saw Diane, she came by the office and I took her out to the parking lot and said, I got something to show you. And I gave her the keys to the Porsche. And people read the article, but the tragedy is that she killed herself in that Porsche. It wasn't her driving. She and her boyfriend was driving, but there'd been some drinking going on and he had some criminal issues, but we lost her at a very unfortunately young age, and she was just an extraordinary talent. And wish for a lot of reasons she's still with us,
yeah.
But she's not.
So there's a few other notable films in the years immediately after there. We've got A Chorus Line, other stuff, but nobody. I would put your 1987 up against anybody else's year ever. So. Can we just say, first, there's Fatal Attraction. You're the happily married husband whose marriage is jeopardized by an affair. And then there's Wall Street as Gordon Gekko, who we all know. And I guess I just wonder if we can tackle each of those briefly.
Sure.
Because there were, from what I understand, Sherry Lansing's said there were oral histories. There are different things about Fatal Attraction. There were people who, it sounds like, a lot of people didn't think Glenn Close could play this kind of a sexy character. And also that, could you be sympathetic as this guy who's done
Correct.
Some bad things? So would you ever have imagined that, given that context, this thing became one of the biggest hits of the 80s?
Well, it was a great concept. Right. It was a great what if, you know, for anybody that ever fooled around, here is your worst nightmare. What if? So the concept was great. Glenn was, you wouldn't think, you know, when you think of a seductress, this or that. But Adrian Lyon was so smart in the fact that first off, I said, listen, let's just not make it like, you know, the wife and this beautiful seductress. So we made Ann Archer, my wife, who was, wow, beautiful. And the whole story was, why would you ever mess around when Ann Archer was your wife? Well, you know, people are strange. Right. But, and then when we came to casting, Glenn, she was not the first choice. I mean, Adrian liked her a lot, and I personally, I loved Glenn, but wasn't certain. And Glenn came in, and she auditioned, something she would have normally done at that point in her career. She came in, and she just knocked it out of the park. I mean, she just totally knocked it out of the park. So we were really happy, and we had our Alex. She was just great. And then there was always this worry about, well, who are you going to root for? You got, you know, Glenn Close destroying the family, and you got your part as an adulterer. And I remember going with Sherry Lansing to our first screening of the picture, and there's a sequence in the movie after Glenn Close and I have been together where I come back to my house get in and mess up the bed, to mess the whole bed up, like to show that I'd been there. Right. And the audience laughed. And Sherry grabbed my arms. I can't believe this. They've forgiven you already.
Right.
And so I think that's the first time, well, it was a big success, but also this ability for audiences to forgive me,
mm-hmm.
To play parts that are not necessarily heroic, dark, gray area, but ultimately audiences were willing to forgive me.
What's your theory on why that is?
I'm a nice guy.
Well,
I said, you just see through it.
No,
I think people, I think just, you know, Scott, I grew up, my dad, you know, those are a generation of good guys and
right.
bad guys,
right.
white hats, right. black hats, you know, it was pretty clear. But I think, you know, I'm a product from my youth of the Vietnam War and that gray area where it was hard to say things of what was right and what was wrong, and just we're in a world of gray areas where it's just things are not clear
right.
anymore. I mean, that was part of why you hope our support for Ukraine, because it seemed like such an obvious attack, and why we should, you know, it's support our democratic system.
That's the other wild card, I guess, with Fatal Attraction. I've read about a man named Joseph Farrell, who was a marketing executive at Paramount, who apparently was the initial advocate for, all right, we've got this movie in the can where initially Alex Forrest, Glenn Close's character, you know, is depressed and kills herself. And according to what his market research showed, people didn't want her to kill herself. They wanted her to get killed. So how did you feel when this idea 6 months later comes up that we need to potentially reshoot the ending here?
I was clear when I first saw the screening, and even with Sherry, that Glenn did such a great job and was such a good villain that although it was a wonderful ending in terms of her succeeding, that she will kill herself but make it look as if I murdered her and that she would ultimately win out. But you want, and the audience went, no, you don't kill them, you know. So they want revenge. And it was clear when I first saw the picture that there was an issue with the ending, and as beautiful it was, but the resolution. Well, Glenn, and I certainly understand that, was not happy. She thought in terms of her character, and it was right. She was right. In terms of her character, this was the full arc. This is where it should be. So we had to have a lot of discussions, and I remember reaching out to her because of her theater background. I said, Glenn, when you're in a show, even if it's going to go to Broadway, you go out of town, right? Yeah. And you try the play out. And based on the audience's reaction, people make script adjustments and all of that. This is the same argument about marketing movies. Like people say, it's ridiculous. Of course you have. Of course you do. You have to. you know, you're making what somebody's entertaining. Yes, there are artistic statements, but you got to want to make the movie succeed. And so we worked around in the sense, and listen, but it doesn't, it's not working because you're so good at playing Alex. So I was, you know, I didn't know what the answer was, and Adrian Lyon, our director, was able to come up with a kind of a ripoff of Diabolique, finale to get it, and it was ultimately a huge success.
So that's just part one of 1987. Then you have Gordon Gekko, this slick corporate raider, this cocky guy. I heard you did the hair slick back as a Pat Riley homage.
Pat's an old friend of mine. Ultimately, that's how it ended up.
Well, so the thing, if you say Gordon Gekko, everybody says greed is good, right? It comes to mind immediately. And I wondered, I just watched it again prepping for this, it's 3.5 minutes. It's a kind of tour de force thing you're saying at this annual meeting of Teldar paper, just a knockout. And I heard, in fact, that you did it in one take. You get a standing ovation from the 600 extras or whatever who are there. Did you immediately realize how kind of the potential of this speech? And do you remember, was it hard to learn, fun to deliver? Just anything about that? Because I think for as long as there are, you know, movies, there are going to be people talking about that.
Yeah. Well, it was a great part. It was beautifully written, Oliver Stone being one of the co-writers. And look, Oliver has an incredible history with actors in his movie, not so much actresses. But if you look back, starting with Al Salvador, with Jimmy Woods, Tom Cruise in Born on the 4th of July, Charlie Sheen in Platoon, Kevin Costner in JFK, Val Kilmer in The Doors, me, every actor's probably given their best performance with Oliver Stone. Why is that? He's a tough guy.
Yeah.
He's a tough guy in the best sense of the word. In terms of him challenging the actor, it's as if he was back in Vietnam and could I trust you in the trenches with me? So I've told the story many times, but you know, by the second week of shooting, Oliver came into my dressing room and said, "You okay?" I said, yeah, I'm okay. I said, "You doing drugs?" No, I'm not doing drugs. So, because you look like you never acted before in your life.
Oh, my God.
Gordon Gekko shrivels up. tough. And I said, well, I guess I don't like to look at the dailies because I only see what's bad, not what's good. And so just wanted to start looking, unless there's a problem. So I go look at the dailies of a couple of scenes. There was a seduction scene in the back seat with Charlie Sheen, another one, the 21. I look at the scenes and I think they're pretty good. I think they're pretty good. So I see Oliver. I said, "Oliver, I thought it was pretty good." He said, "Yeah, it is, isn't it?" I said, what are you doing? What are you doing? And Oliver wanted a little more nastiness from Gordon Gekko. And he wasn't afraid for the rest of the show for me to be so pissed at him, you know. And what did I ultimately do? I ended up working on that part so hard. And I, yes, I had some long dialogue speeches, and I'd do them brushing my teeth. I'd do them standing on my head. I would do so I had it, you know, this way and that way. And probably what they were plotting about that day is we shot that scene 6 days to Sunday, up in the rafters, this and that. And they finally came in for my close-up. I mean, I couldn't believe after all of that. And I did it, the first take.
Right.
And he said, okay, let's move on. And that's what they did. So that's what happened.
That's
but I practiced, yeah.
Just the random thing that I have to ask. If somebody, if you had a gun to your head today, could you do the whole speech again?
No. I mean, my memory, that's another story you want to know. No, my memory makes me very nervous about, dialogue now. Sure. It takes a long time.
Well, also went back and watched your speech accepting the Best Actor Oscar for that, and you said something that was very interesting, which was in thanking your dad, who had never won a competitive acting Oscar, which is crazy, you spoke about, you know, thank you for allowing me or helping me to emerge from the shadow.
Step out of the shadow.
Can you talk about that and also the fact that, as you've noted, I think maybe with some hindsight, there were a lot of parallels with your career starting. I mean, the role here that you got the most recognition for as an actor up to that point is, in some ways, the first time you play a real asshole. And there had been something like that with your dad, right?
No, very much. It was funny. My dad began his career playing about his first six pictures were like playing the sensitive young man in about six pictures, you know, kind of feel. And then he did this little independent picture called Champion in 1949. He got nominated for an Academy Award. It was an amazing performance and sort of created his image that we have of him, his teeth, his gritting, and that intensity,
right.
And changed his whole direction. And then ironically, yes, but the truth be told, Scott, you know, playing a villain is usually the best acting roles there are, because you vicariously are doing something that nobody else really gets a chance to. Going back to Cuckoo's Nest, when we were casting Nurse Ratched,
yes,
Louise Fletcher, who won the Oscar, was not a very well known, but over five actresses had turned the part down, because of that part in the women's movement and everything else, it was inappropriate to play a villain. Which is what guys, all you want to do is get that good villain part.
Right.
But that set me also on a road to dealing with ambivalence, dealing with that gray area. I like that area, which is sort of unpredictable. People can't quite figure out, you know, where it's going.
Oh, that's amazing. With your permission, I'm going to tee up just a few other of the many great ones, and then we're going to, in the home stretch, of course, focus on Franklin. But how do we leave out Basic Instinct, which in a sense is to the 90s, I think, what Fatal Attraction was to the 80s. Just this, in some ways, Hitchcockian, like, cautionary thing about, you know, people are getting, I don't know, some people say it's because of AIDS hovering over society, but just the downside of being, of sex, right? What would, you know, would you have guessed that that one would be such a hot button movie with everything involved there with you and Sharon Stone and everything?
Yeah, well, I remember we wanted to do it. It was a conservative time. People had all pulled back on sex in the cinema since the 60s and 70s, per se. And I remember I wanted to do a slam dance. I really wanted to do something. I just had that feeling. And Paul Verhoeven was just a spectacular director. I'd seen his earlier Dutch films. And he has that in-your-face sort of feeling. So Joe Esterhaus's script came up. And we wanted to do it. And it's probably the most commercial picture I had in my career. I got to just jump back for one second, please. Scott, because two pictures which we have not mentioned, which I really love, was Black Rain.
Yes.
With Scott, with Ridley Scott.
Yes.
And The War of the Roses.
Absolutely.
Which were good. Anyway, we'll go ahead. But those were
back. No, but absolutely. And I
you can't go everywhere.
No, well, I want to, but I don't want to keep you here forever. No, these are wonderful. And I know Falling Down for Joel Schumacher, that's another one that I think you and others feel maybe deserves to be remembered even more than
that. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a good one.
That's 93, this guy, Defense. American President. I mean, the thing that one brings up from 95, it's you and you're the president, you're having an affair with this lobbyist played by Annette Bening. But I think it's kind of interesting that so often your leading ladies, and we can go back through Sharon Stone in Basic Instinct, and so many of these others that Kathleen Turner and a bunch of your female co-star, I think, almost always gives as great, if not the greatest, performance of their career opposite you. What's the rhyme or reason of that?
Thank you, Scott. Yeah. I'm actually very proud. That's not a fact that a lot of people acknowledge and recognize. In part, it's because they had great parts. Romancing the Stone, the reason I couldn't get a major actor for it was because the female's role was the major dominant role of the film. So I think it's just been part of that. And that Benning had a lovely part in that. And I made sure Demi Moore was really good. So all of them seem to have good parts, and I've had good chemistry. But I look back and think that most all the actresses I've worked with, probably their best work was with me, and something I'm very proud of.
Oh, that's great. You were there early on in David Fincher's career with The Game, is only his third movie after Aliens 3 and 7. And this one, I mean, he's obviously gone on. You were a believer there early on. A Perfect Murder was the year after that in 98, and I think maybe the greatest legacy of that was that it led to you meeting your wife,
right?
With the greatest pickup line of all time.
Right.
May I prompt you to just remind?
Perfect Murder. We were I was on a promotion tour in Europe, and just finished the whole tour. We were ending up in Deauville. And I'm looking at the schedule of what they do at those film festivals. They have a picture every night,
right.
and then you do a Q&A afterwards. And I was doing The Perfect Murder, and then I'm looking at the schedule, and I see the next night, Zorro is coming. And about 2 weeks before, I had seen Zorro in a private screening in Los Angeles. And just, I mean, not since Julie Christie. And I go, who the hell is, wow,
right.
Jesus, Catherine Zeta-Jones, man. So now I'm in Deauville, and I see, I am single.
Yes.
I see the next night that Zorro's coming, so I ask my assistant with me, can you find out if Catherine Zeta-Jones is coming for this screening, and if I could have a drink with her? And he gets back to me, he says, yes, she is coming, she's coming alone. And have a drink. She's only here just for the evening, for the night, because she's in the middle of doing this movie, Entrapment, with Sean Connery. And so they come in, and we have a drink, along with Antonio Banderas is there, and Melanie Griffith, I know, so it's a loop together. We have a drink, it's all nice. And then they invite me to dinner, and so is that okay, Catherine? Sure, that's all right. So we have dinner together, and then they have to go off and do the Q&A after the screening. And I go back to the hotel bar to celebrate because I'm all done. I happen to mention Cat by any chance I'll be in the bar, you know. And I'm sitting there getting whacked in the bar, having done my whole promotion tour, going home, and sort of like a mirage through the lobby. It looks like Catherine Zeta-Jones. And, oh, my gosh, she's heading this way. And it wasn't. So she stopped by, and we had a drink together, and then we find out we have the same birthday.
Yes.
I cannot believe it. 25-year difference, right. I understand, but same birthday. Oh, my goodness. Then we find out, and we're talking. Do you like golf? She says, I love golf. I said, really? And then I look at her and says, you know what? I am going to be the father of your children.
How did that go over?
Not well.
Not well.
Didn't go over well at all. She said, well, you know something? I've heard a lot about you.
Yeah.
I've read a lot about you, and I guess it's all true. Good night. And she left. And so I thought, oh, man. And she'd gone early in the morning, and she had to go up to the Isle of Mull above Scotland and all that. And I went, oh, so I've blown this. I've totally blown this. And then I said, all right, well, I've got to, I said to my assistant, get a big bunch of roses and send them to this place where she is, the Isle of Mull, and, you know, with an apology, you know, from me. And I always wanted to thank that florist, because somehow in one day she arrived in Scotland, took the ferry boat over to this island to get there, and waiting for her there, oh, Mrs. Jones, you won't believe what you got. There's a bunch of flowers here for Mr. Michael Douglas. And so that saved the day, and the rest is history.
That's awesome. Okay, a less happy story I know for you, you've said, is Wonder Boys, because this is a great movie. A lot of people, David Thompson, who's a pretty admired critic, for example, said, wrote at the time that this was, let me find it here, maybe the best performance Douglas has ever given, close quote. There were a lot of that. This is a pot-smoking writer having a kind of a midlife crisis, Curtis Hanson directing. It just never got seen.
It never did. It never did. And the studio, it was Sherry Lansing again. The studio even gave it a different, a second release the same year in October. Robert Downey Jr., Tobey Maguire, Frances McDormand, Katie Holmes. It was one of those stories. Only thing, the marketing campaign, it was a kind of a goofy picture of me close up. To this day, I can't. I'm really proud of the movie, the job that Curtis did, but it never hit.
And that was one of the bigger disappointments.
That was a big disappointment, yeah.
And in fact, actually, I read a thing where you said that it was a bonding thing in a way with your dad, who'd had another one that he loved, right? That had
Lonely
had some...
Are the Brave.
Yeah.
He had one, you ask him his favorite movie he's made out of the 90-plus movies he did. Would be Lonely Are the Brave. I'd say the same thing. We always believe, sort of like Wonder Boys, we always believe, oh no, but it'll have sometime in the future, it'll be in that list. Never has. Wonder Boys, same thing. Sometimes, I guess sometimes that
just
happens.
Gets away, yeah. Well, on the upside, that same year was Traffic, which was nominated for a zillion Oscars. Steven Soderbergh won Best Director. You are the drug czar whose kid has her own addiction issues. You were reluctant to do that one initially.
I was. I can't remember what the... Oh, I know. There was...
Because there's like three stories there,
there were
right?
There were three parallel stories in there. And at one time, in my story, drugs as the drug czar, the script had me trying cocaine to understand my daughter's situation. And I just, you know, in that position that I had, I mean, I can understand a normal father maybe doing it. I couldn't buy it. As it ended up, the script went on. They eliminated that part. Then I came back into the picture and off we went.
And the weird thing is that somehow around 2000, when that comes out, that's your first interaction, right, with Soderbergh, who at that time... floats the idea of you playing Liberace.
I didn't know what he was going. I looked at him, yeah, okay. I mean, I thought, but Steve, are you trying to tell me, Steve, I'm a little light on my feet here? No. I said, no, not that, no. Just, okay, I'm just something, something you ever thought about. No, it's not something I've thought about.
But and meanwhile, 13 years later, but in the interim, a lot had happened. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, this is the least important, but you did go back for the only time aside from Jewel of the Nile, I think, to do a sequel where it's Gordon Gekko again, Wall Street. But more importantly, you had a pretty tough period there, and then Behind the Candelabra, I know there were some concerns, is this gonna go away or whatever, but you have said that aside from your dad giving you essentially Cuckoo's Nest, the greatest gift professionally you received was having that part as sort of the light at the end of the tunnel. Can you just contextualize that? Was
sure.
That was not a fun time, right?
No. I had stage 4 cancer actually the back of the tongue in the throat. We actually advertised it as through my throat, mm-hmm. because the image of tongue cancer is they got to remove part of your jaw and you can't speak So we just thought, my doctor was very smart. I said, let's just not go there, you know, whatever. And, you got to do all the chemo, radiation, and all of that. And I got through it. I was happy. I was clean. And, you know, there was certainly a time when I didn't think I was ever going to work again. I was pretty sure there's possibility where I could speak and all of that.
Again,
and
a weird parallel with your
with my father and his stroke. It was, he had a thing. And then Stephen, you know, picked up my spirits, by showing this behind the candelabra, this Liberace thing. And it was a kind of a wonderful idea, and it really picked up my spirits. And Matt Damon was going to play my lover, you know, and this and that. And Matt's at the height of his career, and well, certainly not the end of it. And so I'm all excited. And then Steven said, you know, I've got a couple of things I have to do, so I'm going to have to put this off a little bit. And then Matt said the same thing. He said, you know, I've got one project. And I thought it was dead. I really thought it was dead. The reality was I was so happy to be alive that I didn't realize that I'd lost 40 pounds. I still looked like a skeleton. And Liberace, the least of which was a little bit on the heavy side. And these guys, you know, I still get a little emotional about it, rather than putting it on me and saying, you know, you look like a ghost. They said this to give me a year to put on my weight, some weight and everything else. And also, by then I had this part down backwards and forwards. I remember we had a little beach party before we started shooting in Malibu. My kids were there and everything, and Steven was there, and my son Dylan was there, and he was doing imitation. Thank you very much. I would like to do it. And Steven said that I knew we were in good shape, yeah, because his Michael's son was he couldn't stand hearing it anymore. You know,
it was great and a well deserved Emmy and all of that. And that brings us now to the home stretch, where I just think these last approximately 10 years since that project have been really transformative for the industry and interesting for how you've approached it. I mean, on the one hand, the mid-range budget movie, which is what I think so many of your greatest films were, has sort of evaporated in a large part. I mean, you even in this last decade, the ones that you did, which were some you were great in, like Solitary Man, those are endangered. And meanwhile, coincidentally or not, is the rise of these streamers. And you had these, I think it was 4 seasons with the Kaminsky Method.
3.
3 with Netflix, a whole new world of putting out, you know, very different than Streets of San Francisco, to be dropping a whole season at once and all of that. But then, obviously now, a limited series with Franklin. And I just wonder how you first heard about it, and given that you are so associated with contemporary parts, was that part of the allure that you're going back in centuries to play this game?
Yeah. Well, I think what happened, just briefly starting before Kaminsky, was, you know, been doing this for a long time. I think we were probably Kaminsky was like 45 years. And so what can I do? What's different? What can I do that's different? And so comedy is something I've done a little bit before, but I'm just fascinated about it. I mean, I've never understood why comedy is not acknowledged more of the Academy type. Comedy is difficult to do. We all appreciate our funny friends there, you know. And so to work with Chuck Lorre and Alan Arkin was like this godsend for me to learn something else. And to watch Alan Arkin and the kind of Jewish humor about how do you just say, hey, and it's funny.
Right.
I mean, it's like Larry David. How are these things, you know? And so I try to study them, and had a wonderful time to learn a little more about how comedy works. Then we jumped on it, but then the Marvel world,
yes,
with all the Ant-Man pictures, I had never done green screen.
Right.
So now I said, okay, well, let's try it. I've never done green screen. I'm always fascinated how, but it's hard. Acting is hard with green screen. It's amazing. They're really good. So it was like I learned something else about that part, you know, about green screen. On the Marvel films, it was a chance to see how green screen works, which I'd never done before, and got a great respect for when there's nothing much there, and they show you the pictures and behave. So that was great. And then Franklin, Richard Plepler, who used to run HBO for about 20 years ahead of HBO, and who also was head of HBO when I did the Liberace picture,
yes.
Behind the Candelabra. We had a very successful run. Came to me with this idea of playing Franklin, and had a, you know, 1 hour, first hour of an 8 hour miniseries. And I went, wow, you know, Ben Franklin, boom. And so did some, you know, kind of homework on it and all of that.
I was going to ask, how much of this did you, I'd like to think I'm fairly well read and whatever, and yet I had no idea he's going around with the grandson, and he's, that it was truly a make or break thing if he couldn't secure this arrangement with France.
We this is the part that blew my mind. Because I knew a little high school, you know, I knew what an incredible Renaissance man that he was. Yeah. I knew, you know, he came from nothing. Had 2 years of schooling in him, 12 years old, left school, became a voracious reader, became a, you know, writer, great writer, publisher, printer, and then he created the University of Pennsylvania. He created our libraries. He created the post office. Then as an inventor, all these things, I know, is incredible. Yeah. But I didn't know at 70 years old, when he's writing the Declaration of Independence with our other John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, writing the Declaration of Independence, 70, they finish, they sign the Declaration of Independence. And then 6 weeks later, they tell him, or ask him, but tell him that he needs to go to France to gain the support of the French, a monarchy beyond all monarchies, to try to persuade them to support this small, brand new democracy. And I didn't know that. I said, wow. And the reality is, as George Washington was struggling away with a ragtag army and getting clobbered by the British, we had no ships, that it was a question of days that this democracy was going to be over with.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're just going to be another colony of England. And lo and behold, he woos and cajoles and seduces, and he's got spies over there in France and backstabbers to get the French to support America. And just to remind everybody that if it was not for the French,
yeah,
America would not exist.
For all the people that want to go on about freedom fries and all
Yeah,
that.
Exactly. Exactly. So it was a great story, and I'm really happy to say, you know, after having the eight episodes, and we're just in the middle of a promotion tour and everything, now getting a nice response.
Yeah.
It's a really good story. You know, beautifully directed by Tim Van Patten.
Everything from the title credits through the every aspect of it. I mean, this looks like a very the production value and the acting and everything is top notch.
It is. It's a beautifully produced. We had this is a picture takes place in the 18th century. We worked for 160 plus days for 8 hours, and there's only two constructed sets in an entire period picture. That means all of the locations were practical for an 18th century film.
So where were you guys? We were
in Versailles every Monday, because Versailles is closed to the public Mondays, and all these other, you know, chateaus and palaces and places around. It was a wonderful, wonderful production experience. I had a lovely time. France was great. I was the only American actor. It was all French actors and English, and I'm really happy how it turned out.
Would you do a, I mean, like you say, 106, well, your average movie is how many days?
Average movie is 60 days, 50, 60 days.
So you're biting off a lot here. Not that you have, I mean, Streets of San Francisco was a lot, Kaminsky.
I was a lot younger.
Right. But I mean, would you do long form again? Is it something?
I'm not thinking about it. I do know that since we shot this in 22.
Okay.
We ended in November of 22.
Yeah.
And other than a small part that I played in a picture that my son Cameron is doing called Blood Knot, I haven't done anything.
Okay, took
and I'm enjoying it right now. People, I have no desire to work. I'm going to be 80 this year, and I'm having a great time, and I'm sure about saying no, something will come up. But right now, life is good.
Yeah.
You have to pick those moments. Catherine is wonderful. She's going to be going off to do Wednesday, that series Wednesday for Netflix in England. All my kids are good, so I'm enjoying terrific. Life.
And as you say, two big birthdays in the next year coming up.
Yeah.
You and your wife. For people who are keeping track at home, April 12th is when this starts dropping on Apple, a few episodes then rolls out in total through May 17th. I guess, you know, just as a final question, sort of big picture thing, will there, two-parter if you don't mind.
Sure.
Will there be another generation of Douglases in the business? And part B, for you, even though, as you've said, you're well-deservedly, you know, taking it a little slower now, is there anything still on your bucket list as an actor that you feel you really want to do that you haven't done?
Take the last word first. No, nothing. I feel very fulfilled and satisfied and great memories. I'm always looking like for a great piece of material, which irregardless what the role is, if it's a good piece, I'd be very happy to. And yes, as I said, Scott, all three of my kids are actors.
Oh wow!
All three of them.
And would you say you are happier with that? How was your? I forget. Your father was okay with you pursuing acting?
Well, no, he was scared to death of it because he knew, as I realize now, that our actors union is mostly 90% unemployed. You know, so it's very tough. And besides that snarky article about, was it newbies? What do they call it?
Oh, nepo babies.
Nepo babies. Yeah. That kind of thing. I don't know a business where a father or a mother don't try to give a chance for the kid to get into it, whatever it is.
Good, you sink.
Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, you don't good, and God knows there's a lot of second generation kids who are not working out. But so I know how good they all are, as opposed to my father who suffered seeing me on stage for the first time. What have I created? No, this is. You know, and then all of my kids are good actors. It doesn't mean they don't need a little bit of luck, but we're both, Catherine and I, are happy about
it. That's great. Well, thank you for all the work and for doing this, and really appreciate it. Encourage people to watch Franklin. It's a heck of a performance.
Well, thank you, Scott. This was a treat. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.